How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, James Comey explains his memos. The former FBI director goes before the Senate Intelligence Committee today to talk about that meeting in the Oval Office, the request to call off the investigation into Michael Flynn, and what President Trump might have meant when he said, "We had that thing, you know." And why would ISIS be targeting Iran? It's Thursday, June 8th.
This is how it starts. I was asked to testify today to describe for you my interactions with President-elect and President Trump on subjects that I understand are of interest to you. I have not included every detail from my conversations with the president, but to the best of my recollection, I have tried to include information that may be relevant to the committee.
So that's the start of what, Mike Schmidt?
It's the start of a 7-page opening statement that James Comey will be giving on Thursday that lays out the intricacies, the subtleties, and the back and forth that he had with Donald Trump when Comey was the FBI director.
Why release the testimony in advance, a full day in advance of the actual appearance?
I don't know, but it certainly made writing about the testimony without what's going to happen easier. Perhaps to, I don't know, stoke more interest in it.
Right.
I'm not sure, but it certainly gives us a preview of what we're going to see.
So I want to remind listeners of your role in all of this. You first reported on the existence of memos written by James Comey and some of the details of those memos, which I believe were read to you by people who had access to them, right?
Yes. I've written 4 stories over the past month about Trump's interactions with Comey and how Comey memorialized them in memos. As a reporter, when this came out, my first instinct is get it, read it. How does it line up with my reporting?
Hmm. And how did it line up, the actual testimony?
It lined up very well, and that's the best feeling you can have as a reporter because it ensures the accuracy of the content that you've put out.
So what's in the testimonies, and I guess, therefore, what was in the memos that you hadn't seen that struck you?
There's 2 things about this statement that stood out at me. The first was sort of how wide-ranging Trump's efforts were to win over Comey or influence him. How Trump never really gave up on trying to get Comey to put out word that he was not under federal investigation, and specifically why Comey didn't want to do that. Because what Comey's concern was that if he put out word that Trump wasn't under investigation, as he was not under investigation, what if Trump did become under investigation?
Interesting.
Would Comey have to hold a press conference or put out a statement to say that he was? So that sort of back and forth and how hard Trump was trying to get Comey to do this for him was something that I hadn't totally appreciated coming into today.
Mike, I wanted to share with you a passage that I found really striking. It was from this loyalty dinner that you first described in the Times
at the White House. The first thing I found most fascinating was that the president invited Comey originally with his family, which obviously would have changed the dynamic of the dinner tremendously. But then the president sent word, just come by yourself. And at the dinner, the president says to him, and you first reported these words, but here they are in the testimony, quote, I need loyalty. I expect loyalty. And the FBI director writes, I didn't move.
Well, this is the moment.
This is the moment.
This is like the moment, like just dripping with drama. They're sitting there, just the two of them in the White House. The president has been in office for just a week. There's this Russia investigation going on. Comey has no idea, you know, what's going on. Trump's flinging different things at him. And Comey says, I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way during the awkward silence that followed. We simply looked at each other in silence. They're just sitting there.
I guess it feels like Comey felt in that moment that if he had, like, if his lips had moved in a slightly wrong direction, that he would have signaled some sort of consent or something, and he was probably petrified of doing
this. This is, and we should have seen this coming.
What do you mean?
Trump is a man of loyalty. Mm. That is like one of the most important things to him. And Comey is a man of independence. And these two issues are facing off against each other right there in the White House as these two men are eating dinner. These two issues are staring each other down, right, and neither guy wants to make a move.
Mike, what other passages in this testimony stand out to you?
There's a particular phone call, which I didn't know a ton of details about. Mm-hmm. It was on April 11th. The president calls Comey. Now, you have to understand something. Comey says in these documents that Obama never called him when he was in office, but that Trump had called him. They had had 3 in-person meetings and 6 phone conversations.
Just in a very short period of time.
Correct. That's no phone calls with Obama over essentially 2+ years and 6 with Trump.
Hmm.
So what Comey says is that Trump calls him on April 11th and wants to know about when Comey's going to get out the word that Trump is not under investigation. And Comey basically says, look, you know, I told the Justice Department about this. I haven't heard back from them. You really need to go to them to get this information out. It's not really my place to do this. You need to understand the lanes of the road. And then Comey says he said he would do that. And then Trump says to him, because I have been very loyal to you, very loyal, we had that thing, you know. And Comey says,
wow,
I did not reply or ask him what he meant by, quote, that thing.
That thing.
And then Comey says, that was the last time I spoke with President Trump.
Hmm. What is that thing?
That's what we don't understand. Is Trump referring to the loyalty dinner where he asked Comey twice to pledge his loyalty?
Mm-hmm.
Comey declines to do so. And then in a very awkward moment says, you'll have my honest loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Is Trump referring to that loyalty pledge? It's not clear. You get the sense from the statement of how Comey sort of knew that this could go off the rails very quickly. Comey goes up to Trump Tower on January 6th to provide a briefing to Trump about how Russia was behind the hack. And Comey doesn't lay out why he does this, but he says, I felt compelled to document my first conversation with President-elect in a memo. He said, to ensure the accuracy, he said he began typing on a laptop in an FBI vehicle outside of Trump Tower the moment he walked out of the meeting.
That's amazing.
He said that creating these records immediately was not something he had done before under President Obama. He said, this is not my practice. But there was something inside of Comey that he could sense about Trump and the way that things were going with the Russian investigation. He says that I really need to create a paper trail. And he goes on to create these memos about every single interaction that he has with the president. That's 3 meetings in person and 6 phone calls.
All right, Mike, you're maybe not going to like this question because I know you, and I know you might not like it, but has Comey been called to testify in front of the Senate today because of your reporting? I mean, it was after your reporting on the contents of these memos that the Senate wanted to hear from the former FBI director directly. Is that right?
It was certainly a catalyst, but Comey was going to have to go up there at some point and talk, and they were going to want to hear from him. Did we move that along? Perhaps. But my guess is we were going to hear from Jim Comey one way or another.
So what are your big questions as the person who's been kind of the point guy on this for the past couple of weeks going into today's Senate hearing? What do you want to hear Comey explain that he hasn't before and hasn't even in this prepared testimony?
He explained some of it in the testimony, but he needs to, I think, provide a fuller explanation about why is it that he did not tell anyone at the Justice Department about what Trump had said to him in regards to the Flynn investigation. So Trump says to him, look, you need to get past this Flynn investigation.
Right.
And Comey's understanding is, okay, you know, he's telling me to close the Flynn investigation. So that's a big deal for the president. The president's really going outside of his lane on that. And some would say potentially obstructing justice. So why is it that Comey doesn't tell anyone?
And does that question potentially undermine any of Comey's credibility, or is that a stretch?
I don't think it undermines his credibility, but I think it's something that he has to lay out, because he took a very powerful piece of information with him and essentially put it in his pocket and said, let's hold on to this. And he didn't go to the Justice Department and say, hey, look, I think I may have witnessed a crime.
Mike, I really appreciate all your reporting and your help here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In his testimony today, James Comey is expected to say, as he did in his memos, that President Trump explicitly asked him to shut down his investigation into Michael Flynn's ties to Russia. On Wednesday, four top national security officials were asked repeatedly at a different hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee if they had ever been asked to curtail the investigation. They were not so forthcoming.
Why are you not answering
our
questions?
Because I feel it is inappropriate, Senator.
What you feel isn't relevant, Admiral.
But I am not going to answer questions concerning the Russia investigation. I think it's important for you to understand.
And I responded that I'm not going to comment on those conversations.
Why not? I don't believe it's appropriate for me to address that in a public session.
You swore that oath to tell us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and today you are refusing to do so. What is the legal basis for your refusal to testify to this committee?
I'm not sure I have a legal basis.
We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Thomas Erdbrink, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what happened in this latest attack in Tehran on Wednesday?
Basically, two groups of armed men and women attacked two prominent landmark sites in Tehran at the same time. Mm-hmm. First, an attack took place at the parliament, which is like a pyramid-shaped building, massive building in downtown Tehran. Around it, lots of hustle and bustle of cars and motorcycles passing by. And suddenly, these four armed men showed up at the entrance, the only entrance of the parliament, because it's a very well-guarded bunker almost. These people make their way into the building, but fail to reach the main assembly hall where the Iranian parliamentarians are actually having a session.
Wow.
They take some people hostage, they shoot some of the assistants, and in the end, after they were out of bullets, almost 4 hours later, if I'm not correct, they are killed by Iranian special forces. Now, at the same time, 10 miles south at the mausoleum of the founder of the Islamic Republic, this is a sprawling shrine, if you will, with a golden dome under which this Ayatollah Khomeini lies buried. Mm-hmm. Four other people enter, wow. Three women, allegedly, and one man. And what happens is that some shots are fired, then one of the women blows herself up, wow, in the entrance, two people are killed, and then two other women are allegedly arrested, while a fourth one swallows a cyanide pill.
One of the attackers swallows a cyanide pill.
Yes, one of those pills that kills you instantly. So
this is unbelievable.
Both attacks take hours, take the Iranian security forces really by surprise, because Iran has been almost completely safe. Now, this might be hard to imagine for Americans, but Iran is becoming a prime tourist destination for Europeans.
I didn't know that.
And why are they going to Iran? Because it's safe. They can travel around.
Or it was safe, right?
And it was safe, exactly. And the only thing I can compare it to is that this is Iran's 9/11.
Wow.
A strike in the heartland. They thought they were completely safe and suddenly taken by surprise. And a big blow also to the moderate president, Hassan Rouhani, because you might remember he just won elections last month. And he was constantly saying, I've kept this country safe. Well, he's got some explaining to do right now.
We're hearing now that Iran and its leaders are blaming Saudi Arabia, lashing out at Saudi Arabia in the hours since this attack. I truly don't understand that. Can you explain why Iran's government would do that?
Okay, well, I think to explain this really well, we need to take a couple of steps back. We've heard since the Islamic Revolution, Iran is terrorism and terrorism is Iran. So I think many people are bound to think that ISIS, mm-hmm, is actually in some way linked or positive towards Iran.
Right.
But this really is not the case, because their ideologies are completely opposing. ISIS is Sunni, whereas Iran is a Shiite country. Mm-hmm. This is like Protestants and Catholics.
Right.
So Iranians are saying, look, it's the Saudis and other Persian Gulf states that have been financing, supporting, aiding military these Sunni extremist groups in both Iraq and Syria. And for them, Saudi Arabia and ISIS are one and the same. Why? Because Saudi Arabia and ISIS, in the eyes of the Iranians, have the same faith, this really hardcore, the hardline strain of Sunni Islam that is dominant in Saudi Arabia and in ISIS.
So how exactly does ISIS benefit from people dying in central Tehran from an attack on these very important symbols of Iranian government?
Well, if we make the comparison with 9/11, then you can imagine how they benefit. This is a sign that they were able to attack the great enemy of the Sunnis, the flag bearer of Shiite Islam. Mm-hmm. And not only were they able to attack it, they were able to strike it right at its heart. So this is a major victory for all those who support the hardline Sunni cause in the region.
So, Tomas, help me make sense of one more riddle here, which is,
sure,
that Iran is blaming Saudi Arabia for creating a terrorist problem in Iran, but President Trump...
For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this very room.
And Saudi Arabia are blaming Iran for creating terrorists who then hurt both of their countries. I mean, are both right?
Well, this is almost like a Mexican telenovela, right? Like a soap opera, almost. In a way, they're both right, but you have to decipher what they are saying. When you decipher the words of Iran, they are saying, we don't want Saudi and American influence in this region.
Mm-hmm.
When you decipher what President Trump is saying and what the Saudis are saying, they're saying the opposite. We don't want Iranian influence in the region. This is a power game,
right?
And on the chessboard are religion, ideology, and people.
Sounds like what you're saying is this is the very familiar kind of geopolitical brinksmanship, but with the stakes raised by just the sheer horror of terrorism.
Yes, and the fact that everyone is involved.
Tomas, thank you very much. I know this has been a really busy and kind of horrible day, and I appreciate
yeah.
I appreciate your time.
Okay, take care.
Bye. On Wednesday afternoon, President Trump released a statement. "We grieve and pray for the innocent victims of the terrorist attacks in Iran and for the Iranian people who are going through such challenging times. We underscore that states that sponsor terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote." Here is what else you need to know today. After a month-long search, President Trump has nominated a former federal prosecutor, Christopher Wray, as the new head of the FBI to replace James Comey. The Times reports that Wray is a safe, mainstream choice from a president who, at one point, had considered politicians for the traditionally nonpartisan job, and that the pick will likely ease fears within the FBI that Trump would try to politicize the bureau. Wray oversaw the criminal division of the Justice Department under President George W. Bush.
"I am pleased to be able to discuss with you the Justice Department's efforts in the war on terror and how the USA Patriot Act has helped prosecutors and agents on the front lines of that war. Like many of you, I remember where I was on September 11th when I first learned of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon."
He went on to defend Governor Chris Christie against allegations he played a role in improperly shutting down the George Washington Bridge. And he is a partner at a law firm that advises the Trump family's real estate empire. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.